was the inimitable Buffy St. Marie with Civilization. Yeah, seeing Civilization come from an indigenous perspective. Buffy St. Marie. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We will be talking about Civilization. We're doing something a little bit different than the usual. I've got my interviewee, Christopher Ryan, couldn't actually stay. He's traveling this morning. So I had him in the studio yesterday afternoon before he went to speak at Powell's. Boy, I've never seen that many people at the Burnside Powell's. It was just, they just kept on adding chairs and chairs. Seems to be an issue, a theme, a subject that is maybe the time is right to actually question the underpinnings of civilization itself, which we'll be doing for the next half an hour, 45 minutes, depending on when I want to wind this down so I can take your calls. Boy, I love that line, building superhighways to get you places quicker, but when you get there, you just get a little sicker. Just like the information superhighway, the internet, we thought it was going to bring us, oh, such great things, but it brought us Facebook and Donald Trump. Yeah. All right. So, yes, Christopher Ryan, he authored the very provocative Sex at Dawn. He said that he sold more copies at Powell's than the entire Eastern Seaboard. I thought that was a great fact. I went to his talk last night, obviously. And yes, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for several weeks. Dan Savage called it the single most important book about human sexuality since Alfred Kinsey unleashed sexual behavior in the human male on the American public in 1948. He's a good friend of Andrew Weil, who also gives him and lots of other people. I got to know him a little bit. He's a very interesting figure. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to think and say about this interview. So without further ado, let's just go to that right now. So let's just dive right in. So what would you say your goal in writing your new book was?
Well, I guess the overriding goal is to give people the information they need to make a more informed cost-benefit analysis of the value of civilization. In other words, we're inundated with propaganda telling us that civilization is this amazing benefit to humanity, it's the greatest thing any species has ever done, etc. And the flip side of that is that we're inundated with propaganda telling us that life before the state was horrible. Nature red in tooth and claw, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, and all the rest of that. Turns out that's all wrong. Life before the state was not solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, or short. And the benefits of civilization, such as they are generally partial fixes for problems that were caused by civilization itself. So I wanted to try to clarify exactly what civilization has brought to us, what it's cost us, so that people can make a more informed decision as to why they might feel uncomfortable, even if they appear to be winning the game.
So I guess you need to kind of clarify or define what you mean by civilization.
Yeah, well, that's the first part of the book, is really getting into that. Civilization refers to the sort of radical changes in the way people started to live immediately or shortly after the advent of agriculture, which at its earliest was about 10,000 years ago. It's important to understand that anatomically modern human beings, people who look like us, if they walk down the street dressed in contemporary clothing, you wouldn't notice any difference. They have been on Earth for about 300,000 years. So 10,000 years at the earliest, more like 4,000 or 5,000 in most cases, of civilized, settled, hierarchical living is a very small fragment of our total time as human beings. So in order to understand human nature and human behavior and the things that make us happy and anxious, it's important to look at those 300,000 years of human existence to get a real sense for what humans are like. It's like if you want to understand a dog, you study wolves. We are domesticated humans at this point.
So give us a, to use a kind of unfortunate civilized metaphor, so give us your elevator pitch or talk or whatever for how that came about. I know it's an immensely long story, and you know there's been massive volumes of
yeah.
But how do we get not to like here in 2019, but how did civilization come about?
You know, civilization, or to simplify it a little, agriculture, which is the necessary precondition for civilization, arose in different parts of the world at different times. The earliest is in the Fertile Crescent, as I said, about 10,000 years ago, but it also arose independently in southern China, in Cambodia, in the Andes, in Mexico. And essentially, the same conditions existed. Scientists can now see that the same conditions anticipated the rise of civilization in each of these cases. And what that looks like is an increase in resources. So unusually constant rains, a lot of food, the animal populations increased, the more fruiting trees, more food all over, across the board. And then there was a sudden decline, a sudden reduction in rainfall and famine. And so in previous cases, what would have happened is human population would have been reduced through starvation, as it is with all animals. But in these cases, someone figured out how to get around this sudden reduction in food by digging a trench, let's say, from a river to a grove of fruiting trees and keeping them alive. Once that step was taken, it's a ratcheting process that sets in, because the population levels then continue to grow very rapidly. And once you have surplus food, then all sorts of other things kick in, like political hierarchies, women lose their status relative to men, domesticated animals come on the scene, and you have a different relationship between human beings and the natural world, where our ancestors were then trying to control the world rather than adapt to it. And this is a radical change in human behavior and experience.
So jumping to the chase, as it were, since this is kind of this is a news broadcast, if we can sort of bring any sort of news aspect to it, what does it mean for us today? I mean, you talk about the narrative of perpetual progress, sort of the, if you will, the civilizational propaganda machine, which is a drumbeat that this is the only way, and everything else, as you said, was wrong, was bad, and you know we can just go forward. You know that's continually saying that you can't go back; it's impossible. But you yourself say, in a big sense, you can't go back because we have this massive population, we have this massive infrastructure. So what really does it, what you're talking about, really mean for us now?
Well, on a practical level, it's true. We can't go back, and I wouldn't want to go back. We've learned a lot in the last several thousand years. That's very valuable. What I would love to see happen is that we acknowledge the fact that we're going to live in a manufactured world, in a zoo, if you will, right? We're the only species that lives in the zoo that we ourselves create and maintain. So what I would like to do is to design a better zoo, to design environments that respect and understand the environment in which this species evolved. So in other words, I'd rather be an animal in the San Diego Zoo than in the Calcutta Zoo. And right now we're living more like the Calcutta Zoo. We're living, a lot of people, at least in the United States, are working in cubicles under fluorescent lighting and meaningless jobs. Our enclosures and our artificial environment is not a replication of the environment that we evolved in. So what I would like to do, and what I try to encourage people to do, is to find ways to tweak their lives to bring it more into alignment with the life that you're evolved to live, whether that means being more concerned with experiences than possessions, being more attentive to your relationships than to your financial ambitions. You know, the propaganda we're given about what will make us happy doesn't seem to be working. happy, healthy. It doesn't work. So the way to understand what will work is to really get a sense for what kind of animal Homo sapiens is.
So you have this interesting sort of analogy or metaphor of a story you use in your book about a man who holds on to a hot air balloon trying to keep it from flying away in a gust of wind and ends up basically falling to his death eventually. How does that relate to the story you're talking about?
Well, that I told that story as a way to understand why civilization is so hard to, impossible really, to let go of. It's a ratcheting process. As I said earlier, once you have a surplus of food because of agriculture, population starts growing very rapidly. And once the population's growing, then you need more food, you need more land to cultivate, then you have more babies, then you need more land. So you get these expansionist empire kind of civilizations that are very violent and aggressive, and it's impossible to stop because population keeps growing. And so we've been on that, running on that wheel ever since we picked up farming tools and stopped the hunter-gatherer life. That guy, Ian Stevenson, I think was his name, he was just vacationing in Napa Valley, and he was trying to help out, and the balloon started to get away from the professionals, and he jumped in and grabbed it, and the professionals, as soon as the anchor ropes broke, they all let go immediately, because people who work with balloons know you never let both feet leave the ground. Ian didn't know. He held on. And in the article I read about his death, the sheriff was quoted as saying, "We don't know why he hung on." And at the time I thought, are you kidding me? I know why he hung on. We all hang on too long. We all hang on and think, I should have let go before, when it would have been easier. In relationships, in bad jobs, in all sorts of bad situations that just get worse and worse. Anyone who's ever been in a casino probably knows what I'm talking about. So I think for me, it was a powerful story, a very sad story, but it also explains how situations get away from us so quickly. And I think civilization, despite its many ills, as I see it, is very powerful because of that ratcheting process. Once you're in, it's very difficult to get out.
So getting back to the zoo metaphor and, you know, the present moment we're in, because, you know, KBOO listeners, I suspect, pretty much know that we're in a dire, if not desperate, situation on so many levels that you know, it's easy to lose hope, to be overwhelmed, to, you know, so you talk about in your final chapter, a necessary utopia, that this you're referring before to sort of redesign, but you say we need to strategically bring hunter-gatherer thinking into our modern lives. This reminds me of Paul Shepard. He talked about that in his books. You know, the idea that instead of this idea that you go back completely, you know, whatever, like Pol Pot, right, in the Khmer Rouge or whatever. That's sort of the idea that some people have of people who critique civilization. Instead, it's more like a mosaic. It's like there's various, you know, we still have a repertoire of in ourselves of different ways of relating that could be more like the hunter-gatherer. Talk a little bit about more of that, strategically bringing hunter-gatherer thinking.
Yeah, I think an accurate understanding of how hunter-gatherers lived gives us the tools we need to redesign our lives to make them more satisfying. One of the things that's very important among hunter-gatherers, for example, is egalitarianism. People don't like to be told what to do. Non-hierarchical situations, worker-owned businesses, for example, are a replication of that sort of hunter-gatherer mentality. Respect for women and people with varying gender identities, that's a very hunter-gatherer.
And of course, you talk in your first book, your previous book, Sex at Dawn, obviously a different approach to sexuality.
Yeah, which I think goes much deeper in our nature than the sort of culturally imposed approaches that most of us are suffering under. frankly. But, you know, other things, the way we raise children, for example, the sort of respect for the autonomy and individuality of children that you find among hunter-gatherers, as opposed to sort of modern approach saying, oh, they're partial humans, they're partially formed and don't know what they're doing, don't know what they want. You know, a child sleeping alone in a dark room is a terrified primate. There are good reasons that kids cry all night, and we traumatize them, and yet we're told that's the way we're supposed to raise kids. You know, hunter-gatherer approach to nutrition, to movement, to family dynamics, to politics. You know, if you want to tie this to news, the news of the day, anyone who expresses a desire to be considered a leader in a hunter-gatherer group is considered to be absurd and ridiculous and immediately disqualified from a position of leadership. That's kind of the opposite of the way we do things. I think reluctant leadership is something that we all understand. Someone becomes a leader because a lot of other people respect him or her, not because they want to be a leader. You know, it's a very, I see Bernie Sanders, for example, and the sort of movement to the left in the Democratic Party, or certainly in Bernie Sanders' message, as being very hunter-gatherer. He's talking about taking care of everybody. He's talking about looking out for the vulnerable. He's talking about spreading resources in a more egalitarian way. So I think if you look at contemporary politics, you can really see a hunter-gatherer approach, which is a more social democrat, shared resources, tax the rich, versus a hunter, a farming way of life, which is, no, whatever I get, it's for me, the hell with the rest of you. It's a very individualistic approach. So we're still caught up in the struggle between our hunter-gatherer nature and the post-agricultural world that we live in.
Maybe it's no coincidence that so much Republican support is in the rural red states dominated by these massive agribusiness.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, I've got this vision of civilization and institutions as superorganisms in which human beings are embedded. And the superorganisms have their own agendas, which are often in conflict with ours. And so, yeah, I think there's, you know, certainly a very individualistic red state farmer, you know, this land is mine kind of approach. But I think it's also, you know, it's humans against corporations, and I literally see them as living things, and of course they see themselves as living things. They have personhood legally. They have religious rights. It's bizarre. I'm sure you're familiar with all this writing on corporations and personhood, and
oh yeah,
yeah. It's a strange historical moment.
Indeed, indeed. There's the Portland Psychedelic Society conference is actually coming up in this weekend, and I noticed in your second to last chapter, which is called
the Many Voices of God, maybe
in the absence
of the
sacred,
yeah.
Where you not only do you talk about in the context of this idea of happiness, you have a quote from someone saying that happiness ceases to be a normal condition of being alive and becomes a goal. You have this whole idea of people focus on happiness index, and it's very interesting, all that. But yeah, I mean, that really struck me, is the truth of that. Anyway, you do talk about, you know, sort of the use of psychedelics both traditionally and also there's sort of a resurgence now as a way to sort of maybe break the spell of civilization and other things. You want to talk a little bit about psychedelics?
Sure. I've been interested in psychedelics since Halloween night 1980, to be specific.
Fair enough.
I've worked with MAPS for years, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Rick Doblin's a friend of mine who's the head of that organization. Andy Weil and Wade Davis. I've had all these people on my podcast. So that's an area I'm very interested in. And one of the reasons I find psychedelics to be so fascinating and powerful is that in the right conditions, with the right people, psychedelics can break the spell of civilization in a way. They have the potential to help people see through the veils and the propaganda to a deeper truth. And I think it's significant that virtually every society in the world that has had access to psychedelics has seen them as the greatest gift of the gods. And yet in contemporary America, you can still go to prison for longer for having some mushrooms than for killing a person. I think that is a very significant commentary on a society that has a lot to hide, and anything that threatens to expose the fraud at the heart of this society is seen as an enemy that needs to be stamped out. You know, it started with the Christians killing the Mexicans who had the mushroom cults, as they called them, and demonizing the witches in Europe. There's a paranoia around psychedelics that seems to be a result of an essentially false approach to life that is, doesn't want to be exposed. So I think psychedelics are very interesting in that sort of mind-expanding capacity, but they're also fascinating in terms of clinical use. Finally, thanks to Rick and Andy Weil and other people in that world, finally, we're seeing research that's approved by the government that's being done at serious hospitals by serious scientists. And what they're finding is nearly miraculous. The use of psychedelics in helping people with addictions is orders of magnitude more powerful than any other approach. I interviewed Charles Grobe at UCLA, who's been using psilocybin to help children deal with end-of-life issues. These are children diagnosed with terminal cancer. He finds one session with psilocybin relieves their anxiety around dying more than anything that's ever been tried, not only with children, with adults as well. So anyway, the point being, psychedelics are extremely useful in a clinical sense, and they're also very interesting in terms of educational and removing the filters of conventionality.
In one of my Wednesday talk radio shows a few weeks ago, I had on a couple guests talking about specifically psilocybin and the Portland Psychedelic Society, and I brought up the, you talk in your book about, it's impossible not to talk about this in a book about civilization and its negative effects, about the levels of anxiety, depression, the massive use of psychotropic drugs. And I sort of pose this contrast between, the pharmaceutical industry's massive pushing over the last decades of psychotropic drugs seem to be somewhat coincidental with the suppression of psychedelics. Is that something you've thought about?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's ironic because the whole class of SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, I think is what that stands for, that wouldn't exist without LSD. The serotonergic system, the neurotransmitters, the understanding of brain chemistry was really triggered by the discovery of LSD by Albert Hofmann in the late 40s, I believe, because scientists wanted to understand how can such a small quantity of a substance have such radical effects on the brain. And so LSD wasn't made illegal until the mid-60s, I believe, in the United States. And so from the late 40s until then, there were thousands of research papers that were done around LSD. And the serotonergic system was discovered basically through that research into exploring the power and the potential of LSD. LSD was also used by psychiatrists and psychologists. In those days, it was referred to as a psychotomimetic. And so it was used by clinicians as a way to understand psychosis. They themselves took the LSD in order to trip and experience what they thought was something very similar to psychosis, which it probably is in some ways, which I look at that as such a, it's so noble, you know, a doctor who wants to experience the patient's pain and confusion as a way to better understand the patient.
That, instead, it went so far in the other direction.
It did, didn't it? Yeah. And now, you know, my wife's a psychiatrist, and she's just given up working in conventional medicine because she can't bear to just hand people pills and send them back to their fractured lives. It's totally symptomatic treatment at this point. And because certainly in the American medical system, doctors don't have the time to sit down and really talk and really get to understand a patient. So it's just medicate them into a state of numbness. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's not just psychiatric medications. It's also, you know, medications that are given to kids. I think about 25% of boys in American schools are being drugged right now in order to make them compliant.
Within a very artificial, overly structured, overly rigid situation, which is, again, a, you know, back to your zoo metaphor.
Exactly, right. We're putting them in, you know, and I mentioned addiction before. Suicide rates are up 33% in the last 15 years in the United States, up over 50% in the last 10 years among adolescents. Anxiety, depression, they're just off the charts. So when people say to me, or I read books saying, you know, this is the best time ever to be alive and everything's going so great, everything's wonderful, we've had all this progress, I look around, I say, where do you live? You know, what's going on in your life that you think everything's going so well? We've got people sleeping under bridges, and, you know, the prison population is higher than in any other country or any other place in the world.
But if you read Steven Pinker,
why don't you talk
about him a little bit?
You're going to get me in trouble. Does he listen to KABU?
I hope not.
Yeah, Steven Pinker to me is a propagandist for the status quo. I, you know, there are other people I disagree with in Civilized to Death. You know, I spend a fair bit of time disagreeing with Richard Dawkins, for example. But Steven Pinker, to me, seems to be so, I don't know, he sold his soul to the status quo, it seems to me. He is so insistent that things are great and getting better that he fudges facts and he plays loose with his data. And you know, I've called him out on it, and to my knowledge, he's never responded to anything. There's also a section in Sex at Dawn specifically for Steven Pinker, but he never responded to that either.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about Sex at Dawn.
Yeah.
So I read the Wikipedia entry, which was very interesting. I read it several years ago. Okay, that's going to end there. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to fully edit that. And that was my question was, I think, probably fairly unlistenable. There's some really interesting stuff after that, that after I get a complete edit of this, I will put that up on our website. And yeah, so that was my interview yesterday with Christopher Ryan, the author of Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. Just out, he spoke at Powell's last night to a full capacity house, over capacity possibly, and a very fascinating guy. Really glad I got a chance to talk to him. For those of you who don't know, just tuning in, I'm Paul Rowland. I'm the host, regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, one of the 8 to 9 a.m. talk radio slots every Monday through Friday here on KBOO. A couple other just quick notes. There's a reference to the news that I forgot to edit out because the about a 6 or 8 minute portion of that got played on the news. That was the original use of the interview, and I think there's a couple other things that I didn't get to edit out. But I'm really glad I get a chance to put that out. So yeah, what do you think of that? We already have one caller, and the number is 503-231-8187. We got Sean online. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, good morning, Paul. In Anand Giridhar's book, Winners Take All, he talks about Steven Pinker and how someone came up with a way to describe that is you've been pinkered. There's like, pinkering and being pinkered, everything is great and getting better. So I wanted to thank you for that bit of the conversation.
Well, used to be pan gloss.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. I guess what I wanted to add would be, every empire is, representing sort of the pinnacle of civilization. Like every empire that's ever existed, I don't think they've ever said to themselves, let's be evil. Let's go out and exploit our fellow man. Let's conquer foreign lands and steal their resources and enslave their labor. I don't think any empire has ever used that narrative. Every empire always has a way to rationalize what it's doing. So defenders of our current establishment, whether they're, the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, the Hillary Clinton types, that bunch, I don't think they see themselves as evil, but like Derek Jensen had this idea of drinkable water and breathable air. Those are like absolutes. Like if your civilization is not spreading, improvements to the land itself, drinkable water, breathable air, it's spreading consumerism. Capitalism is, utterly dependent on consumerism. Then that's evil. No matter what you tell yourself, no matter how you rationalize and say you're bringing stability or you're bringing civilization, that's just you're rationalizing the evil of spreading this way of life. So that's all I wanted to add to the conversation. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean the idea of bringing civilization, bringing Christianity, the idea that's what they were doing. They were bringing something better. Because that's all they knew, the conquistadors, the Puritans, they, for some reason, they thought their way of life was superior, godly, better, and they just couldn't understand why the indigenous people wouldn't take to their ways and had to be forced. And so, using war and torture and conquest as change agents to actually improve people's situations. What they thought, sure, that's what they thought they were doing. They were quite insane. And now we see the fruits, the terrible, terrible fruits of their insanity, our collective insanity, I guess, our legacy of, the total unraveling of our biosphere itself. Who could have imagined that we could affect the very climate system of planet Earth, but we have by the cumulative effects of civilization. Industrial civilization certainly ramped it up. Capitalism certainly mutate. It was a mutation of it that is basically what's really killing us, but they're later stages of an older process. But looks like we got Camille on the line. Go ahead, Camille. Hello?
Reflect on the comment you just made about how the changes in civilization has led to changes in the biosphere, and that is really what is our greatest issue at this particular time. And you mentioned earlier how listeners of KBOO are alert to that and are really concerned, and there's a sense of anxiety and fear and concern about it. And I want to address that question and point out that, of course, there would be those kinds of reactions to the possibility of the failure of civilization. And what we see is the collapse of the systems that we're living with and trying to accommodate, but really are not at a complete loss to how we're going to deal with these things, and so we're feeling kind of hopeless. And I want to point out that that's expectable, that's normal, and that instead of trying to either deny it or distract yourself from it, to acknowledge it and to accept it and to go into it and to get to the bottom where you can come out the other side with a recognition that there is something to be joyous about in what we have of the life that we live on Earth, and try to protect it and preserve it, even if we expect that due to climate change we may already be too late. And the point that the climate change movement is trying to make is that there's a sense of urgency about this. But what the discussion about civilization suggests is that the time may be gone that we have a chance to save it. And I think we have to recognize that possibility. I'm not making any predictions, but the data point to trends in that direction.
Yeah, well,
I think we have to try to prepare for that. That's all I'm suggesting.
Well, I think this you're getting to some really important things. I want to kind of to try to finesse it. I know we got a couple callers, and we only have 20 minutes, but I think this is really important. So what his point is, we absolutely do not want to save civilization. This is a big thing. And his point, so because you said that the issue is changes in civilization, which is true, but his point is that the underpinnings are deeper than these more recent changes and mutations. They've amped it up. The industrial civilization is what really created the crisis of CO2, but we've been changing the atmosphere for actually thousands of years. The clearing of forests, this process has been set in motion way before. His point is we need to go further back and understand our deeper underpinnings that set in motion this crisis. So he says the same thing you're saying, but maybe slightly different. He lays out three. He says, we are at a crossroads and going back is not an option. I envision three possible futures for Homo sapiens. To one side lie denial and anger, collapse, economic, ecological, political, a swirling, unstoppable Category 7 hurricane of incompetence, indecency, greed, and devout ignorance masquerading as certainty. Maybe we're already so far down the path that there's nothing to be done but prepare for the coming storm. There are tipping points beyond which it doesn't matter whether we clean up our act, et cetera, et cetera. On the other side lie bargaining, this is a second option, lie bargaining and depression. More of what got us here. We'll keep coming up with temporary fixes for the most immediate threats and keep ignoring long-term trends as we have since our ancestors took their first steps out of the garden onto the farm. As the destruction of the natural environment of this planet continues, we will evolve ever further from our organic origins, our fragile meat bodies, upgraded piece by piece with technological adaptations to a world increasingly toxic to living things. And he goes on with that. Straight ahead lies acceptance. What if we strategically bring hunter-gatherer thinking into our modern lives by, for example, replacing top-down corporate structures with peer progressive networks and horizontally organized collectives and building an infrastructure of non-polluting, locally generated energy? And he goes on with that third scenario. I think it's a subtle but really important distinction that he's making, that we need to get deeper into ourselves and change the way we are.
I agree with that framing. I would just say that I think the idea of preparing for the storm and preparing, or by looking back at the hunter-gatherer approaches, really are the same thing. And it's a deep adaptation to what may be inevitable near-term collapse. And that means we have to recognize it, we have to confront it, we have to try to do what we can to prepare for it so that we don't go out in a state of barbarism.
Yeah, no, I agree with that also. And they're not. And the important thing is that we don't see them as somehow mutually exclusive. We're really challenged. You know this as much or more perhaps than I do, that we're our binary thinking, our thinking itself is challenged. We can no longer. We have to think much more in much more nuanced way that we're really not used to. So, yeah, we can't focus exclusively on the sort of idea of adaptation, and so, because that kind of can get into sort of a almost a technical pragmatic. We have to also really challenge ourselves to look at our the way we selves. That's why he talks about psychedelics as an interesting tool.
I think that what you're saying is that, yeah, these are very new and different ways of thinking that we have to consider, and if we don't recognize it, we won't think about them. And what I'm concerned about is that the climate movement is trying to preserve things the way they are, and as long as we think about that, we're not going to think in these new, different ways to try to recognize what we have to change and recognize the systems that brought us to this point that we have to really try to go beyond.
No, this is a very difficult conversation, and I would like to continue specifically with you, but we do have two other callers that I also have to respect, and that's just the way it is, Camilo. But thank you, as always.
I'll be discussing this on Monday on More Talk Radio with Cecil.
Okay, right on. Sounds good.
We'll
look forward to that. Thanks for that. Okay, Brian is up next. Go ahead. You're on the air, Brian.
Thank you very much, and I hope to continue a good conversation. This is so important. I would love to see more time devoted at KABU to it. I first got interested in this subject from a guy that I heard at KABU back in 1993, William Kottke, when he wrote the book, The Final Empire, The Collapse of Civilization. Paul, you probably remember that.
I was actually housemates with Bill for a while, yeah. Okay, I remember when he was finishing that book up.
I would recommend it to people interested in this. I saw the talk last night, very interesting book, look forward to it. Just to bring in some of the things, and just to carry on, I have so many things I'd like to talk about. I mentioned to the author last night, Christopher, if he was familiar with Daniel Quinn. Daniel Quinn wrote a book called Beyond Civilization, really analyzing the problems of civilization and seeing what might be a way forward to something new, because we're not going back to what we had. The thing that the gentleman that was on mentioned was about kind of gratitude of this time, and he mentioned last night some of the characteristics of tribalism, and one of those, or of the tribal people, indigenous people, and one of those was about being grateful that we're here, grateful that we do have everything we need. Daniel Quinn, one of the things he talks about what to do, we obviously need to have a paradigm shift, but there's something in our current belief system, this is what he identified, a meme, a part of our DNA, that we believe civilization is just the greatest invention, and therefore anything else would be a step backwards. It can't be surpassed. And he talks about, I was going to ask Christopher last night if I got a chance, we talk about this 300,000 years we lived one way, and then the last 10,000 years a part of us lived a different way. If you had a button and you could push right now to go back to living how we lived 20,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, and obviously had all the skills to survive there, how many of us would push that button?
Well, it's impossible because we can't, our imaginations cannot go there. We're so constrained by the conditioning in which we were living in that it's way beyond comparing apples and oranges. It's comparing, right. we're almost different species. We've changed that drastically. So yeah,
we are an accelerated thing. Daniel Quinn talks about mother culture. You know, what keeps us in place? What keeps all societies in place? And if you aren't familiar with Daniel Quinn and mother culture, it's like once you understand what's this ambient messaging that's going on in our society that supports the continuation of exactly what we're doing, you can't believe that no one else can hear it. It's just around you in every news story all the time. In fact, Christopher Ryan today mentioning the food problem and the connection to food and how we grew, it's exactly what happened. Food is the fuel for this population growth. But where he broke down is, and falls into the mythology of our culture, is that we have to keep producing more food to feed people, when actually producing more food ultimately turns into more human beings. That's what it does.
Well, I don't know about I prefer going the direction that he goes in changing our thinking. We can't we have to where are the points? I mean, that you see the, when you start talking like that, then you start going down the road of, you know, where people people think that people critique civilization are like Pol Pot. You know, that you want to just like people to die off or something. That's right.
That's not the answer. This could be a whole conversation, and it's worthy of a conversation. And I'll take it offline with you at some point, because okay. I'd love to have the conversation. But I will just say that, we need to change. I'll let somebody else get on the air. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I'd love to see just one show dedicated to this. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we are dedicating a show. Oh, you mean like a regular show? That would be interesting. Okay. Well, we got Tom up next, and we got about 10 minutes. So, and we got Michael after that. So go ahead, Tom.
Hi, and thank you for bringing Christopher Ryan to your show. That was my first exposure to his thoughts and ideas, and I really appreciated what he had to say. Like the previous caller, I have been well acquainted with the work of Daniel Quinn, starting with his first book in the 1990s, Ishmael. And what Christopher had to say during your interview with him echoes a lot of what Quinn had to say about our origins as a wild species connected with the earth and foraging societies for hundreds of thousands of years. And his body of works through Ishmael and Beyond Civilization and other books, he goes very deep into explaining the mechanisms, how we got from being a wild kind of species to a domesticated kind of species under civilization. And like Ryan, he also goes into criticizing, you know, what civilization has wrought for us, especially on the negative side. I think you or Christopher had to say about our society has a lot to hide now. And so when you are exposed to that kind of thinking and it reaches you, it can put you into a sort of depression or a state of, mourning over this lifestyle that we've been inculcated with, which now appears to be fraudulent, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found most compelling about what Ryan had to say is that he does work, he builds upon what, say, Quinn had to say, and especially in the direction of what do we do now. And I love that what he had to say about, you know, characterizing civilized people as being a domesticated version of humanity. That was something Quinn also had to say.
Mm-hmm.
But further, I love that comment where he said, what we really need to do now is not go back to living in a foraging kind of society, but to design a better zoo for ourselves.
Yeah, no, I thought that was very challenging because, you know, obviously, however many billion people can't live as foragers. If we did that, would be the final death knell, you know, of the natural world, because the ecosystems can't, you know, there's a lot of people who argue that there's actually a good the concentrating people in urban areas in some ways is a good sort of triage maneuver, because, you know, we can't spread out all over the globe completely, because it would completely wreck whatever's left. Anyway, I thank you for that. And if we could go on to our next caller, that'd be great. We only have about 5 minutes left. I would like to say a few things, but may not have time for that. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I see a lot of analogies to evolution in this. There used to be only single-celled organisms, and then multi-cell organisms evolved. And I think what's going on now is that humanity is evolving into a multicellular organism where...
Well, see, there's a difference what they call natural evolution, you know, is something different from what you're talking about is like what you might call social evolution. But the analogy between what you might call social evolution and natural evolution, there's no actual analogy there. They're not the same process. That's an important distinction to make.
I don't I don't agree with you. I'm being very literal about this. I think that, for instance, right.
Well, we disagree then.
Yeah, the internet, for instance, the internet is like the planet is developing a nervous system.
Well, I think have you read much about actual biology and actual natural evolution?
Yes, a lot. DNA and all kinds of things like, you know, for instance.
Well, it's not just DNA. No, it's we're talking about if we're talking about Homo sapiens, we're talking about the fact that we evolved as hunter gatherers as small, you know, 50 to 150 bands. That was people. That was our evolution. That's how our repertoire, our social, and even some of our physical repertoire evolved in a certain ecological context, in a certain way. And his thesis. You should read his book, and then we could actually have a conversation about it.
Well, wait. Let me say this one thing. Cells evolved as cellular life for billions of years, and now we're living in bodies made out of those cells. Those cells didn't evolve to be part of multicellular bodies any more than we evolved, the way you're talking about, to be part of multi-human organisms at a higher level. But just because evolution went one way until a higher level got started doesn't mean that it still isn't evolution at that higher level.
Well, it's a mutation. This is it's a social mutation that's had disastrous consequences. If you want to continue with this disastrous social mutation that's basically killing the planet, you know, that's your choice, that you've gone that way. I choose to look at it as this is a flawed mutation experiment that is taking us in a bad direction, so we need to actually correct our course. So we have a very different point of view on that.
Okay, but do you want to, for instance, give up a power grid? I don't think you can.
Yeah, I do.
A
I do. Yes.
So you don't want electricity anymore?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, you know, there are still single-celled organisms living all over the planet who aren't part of multicellular organisms. What's stopping you from going out into the wilderness someplace and living without electricity?
Oh, well, you know, we only have like 2 minutes, so really that's not something that is even possible to go into at this point. That's a straw argument. No, I don't want to go off into the wilderness by myself because I want to live in a communal situation. Given the situation, I think Christopher Ryan's idea that we need to design a better zoo for ourselves may be our only and best option. What I would, you know, the idea of eliminating, you know, all the technology, sure, I could say that's what I want, but that's ridiculous. That's like, I can't make that choice. I have no power over that. I would like us to completely go back, but you know, that's a false narrative, and we're not going to do it. So I think that we do need to take what Christopher Ryan says very seriously, that we need to look at ourselves, how we evolved as hunter gatherers, as a possible model for maybe tweaking the overall system that we're living in a better way. Anyway, I think that's probably the best way we can go, but we're about out of time, Michael. So thank you for calling. Okay. I wish we could have a longer conversation about that, because I know you've called in. I know we have a radically different and kind of provocative difference that needs to be explored, because I think probably most people in civilization actually, if you scratch the surface, think more like you, which is not a bad thing. But I think this is where it's such a desperate, I think, juncture, crossroads, that these things need to be discussed much more deeply. And we should devote way more time to it on KABU and elsewhere, as Brian suggested. But we are out of time here on Wednesday Talk Radio. And so I'm going to leave it at that. I'm Paul Rowland. Be back with you next week. Stay tuned for more great programming here on your community radio station.